absolutely. I mean, parents were pushing me hard. Like, you know, it's doctor, engineer, or failure. Oh, which one's going to be?
Oh, yeah.
Which of three you picking? Family, yeah. And yeah. It was going to be, we weren't going to be a doctor, we weren't going to be an engineer. You know, I was one of those kids that did enough to not get kicked out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just enough to get by.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, guys, welcome back to the Property Strategies Podcast.
Welcome.
Back again.
We are.
Who are we here with today?
You got your boy Agoke in the building.
You got your boy Akin in the house. And we've got a special guest.
Special guest.
We've got Saj Hussein in the building.
Hello, hey. Saj.
Hey, guys.
How you doing?
I'm very good. Thank you so much for having me.
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. Can you just a quick one or two lines. Who are you? Who is Saj Hussein?
So I've been doing property about 15, 16 years. Done lots of different strategies, Birmingham-based, and predominantly built the business using other people's money.
Mm. Brilliant, brilliant. Thank you very much. And thank you so much for coming on the pod today.
You're welcome.
I know you're a busy guy, so thank you for taking the time out to come on. We're going to start, what we like to do when we get people on the podcast is just start right from the beginning. So 15, 16 years ago, before you even got into property, what was you doing beforehand? Would you, I guess maybe uni, after uni, what career would you be in?
So I was at a university at Wolverhampton, actually. And one day we'd kind of worked out how much rent we were paying our landlord.
Okay, that early on.
This must have been about late 80s, actually, 89, something like that. And we kind of worked out, actually, you know, we should be doing this. And so we went out and looked at property in Wolverhampton, and they were typically 25, 26, 27 grand, three, four-bedroom house.
Wow.
And we thought, this is what we should be doing.
Back then.
Then we found out about mortgages and then endowment policies and a few other things, and then there was a, you know, usual party at the weekend and that, and then we moved on to the next thing.
I thought you were about to say, yeah, then I learned and I start from there and no.
And we never did anything with it.
It's always like that.
And when we look back now, I think, oh, it's crazy. If we only, then we actually did do something with it.
Mm.
Then those houses are probably, you know, 170, 180 grand now, little Absolutely. Boxes there. But I mean, I'd made the decision that I didn't want to work for anybody else. I wanted to do my own thing. And we were at a height of recession. There wasn't really a lot of opportunities. You know, black, Asian background, you weren't going to get the decent jobs that everybody else is, you know, the nice posh jobs. Exactly. You weren't going to get one of those. So you got to make your own way. So I had an interest in computers for quite a long time. And we decided starting an IT company would be the thing to do. And at that time, I mean, it sounds really exciting, but it's really about just supplying computers. In the early days where most offices didn't even have a computer on the desk. That's what we were doing. And then it evolved into networking, putting network servers and stuff in. And we ran for about 14 years.
Oh, wow.
And we kind of, some of it was right timing, right place. Some of it we did okay. And we did make quite a lot of money during that time. But then some of it goes to your head a little bit and you think everything you touch turns to gold. And I was humbled and realized actually that's not the case. Made quite a few mistakes, and ultimately that business I had to put into administration. It kept tumbling down. And you know, we had millions of pound turnover. We were doing quite a few staff and everything went. So there's
was that a managed service
So then it was supplying actual equipment,
It
was doing maintenance and support contracts, schools, listers, accountants, that sort of stuff. We were doing, so one side was doing really well, making good money. The other side was kind of draining money. And sometimes we need to know when we need to stop and not keep putting money into the black hole, which I was doing. And during that time, actually, we bought a house by accident. I said by accident because my dad was trying to push me and my wife and said, look, you know, you kind of need to move on now. And so we bought this house that wasn't that far from our offices. And that we sold in the end. I think we made like 80 grand or something from it, doing nothing. We just bought it.
Yeah.
And so when we look back afterwards, after we lost the IT business and stuff, and so, you know, what's the one thing that made us the most money that we did the least amount? Property. It was that property. And when I looked around, many of the wealthiest people I knew, and they're all making money from property, or they kept money in property. And the timing was such, it doesn't matter. At that point, it didn't matter what you bought. You know, everybody's making money from property because the prices were just rising. So that's what got me thinking about property. The challenge, I didn't have any money then. So it was, how do you start? How do you do this thing? There was no Facebook groups or stuff at the time. A few networking events and few seminars, a forum. There used to be an online forum, and that was it really. And we kind of started learning a little bit from there.
It's interesting that, you know, obviously you started property by accident. I want to kind of get insight into like how was Birmingham and West Midlands at the time, because obviously I came in 2013 for uni. Suppose my age. But you know, at that point, even from then till now, you know, Birmingham and West Midlands have developed so much. So like, you know, what was it like back then? Not only the city in terms of buildings, but just like the whole feel of the area and just things like that.
I think although Birmingham is the second city, it's always felt like it's the poor cousin of Manchester.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
Never really it never really took off until recently. You know, I think the big change happened when the HS2 was actually going to go ahead. It looked like it's going to go ahead. That's when we saw things just starting to go a little bit mental in City Centre, some of the bigger companies moving to here. But in terms of residential prices, when I first started back 2006, and price was still strong then, the market was strong. It was late 2007, everything started changing. And at that time, the market was still very buoyant, and I actually started out and went off to Stoke-on-Trent because I heard property was very cheap there. And you could actually buy a house for £10,000.
Wow.
But, you know, you probably wouldn't want to live there.
Yeah. Yeah. Being to Stoke, I know what you're talking about.
If you drive through the traffic lights, you know, you stop and jack up, you can't take your wheels. No, it's not. I mean, Stoke's not that bad. But I ended up in Stoke because I just heard it was cheap. I was active in Stoke for a couple of years. And then 2008 market started changing completely. I think 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 is probably when we done really well. Then 13 started changing. Then I think 2014 onwards, up until probably last year, I think we've just been on like a steady upward trajectory in terms of prices.
I'm going to take it back. I'm going to take it back a bit, and I'm going to come back again. In regards to when you started, and you said something earlier, you said you just knew you didn't want to work for anybody. It's always important to kind of go back to where that started from, that sort of mindset. Yeah. Where did that come from? Because I'm sure there's a lot of people at the moment at home wanting to do more. You know, you wasn't born, Saj wasn't born today. Like, it came from somewhere. So just, where did that mindset kind of come from?
Yeah, I mean, we were your typical working class, you know, poorish family in the sense that you got by, you know, it's not that we didn't have food to eat. But, you know, you knew you weren't comfortable at that time in the 80s when I was at school. You know, racism was just rife, and you used to see some of the middle class kids, like the designer tops and stuff was all the fashion then. Your tikinis and your stuff, and that was just like
back then.
In the day, man, that was it. But the, you know, when you had you know, a couple of pounds pocket money, and somebody's wearing £100, you know, jacket, it just didn't make sense. How is that even possible? And I think that's where the desire for being able to want more came from. It's a case, you know, we could do more. I mean, we should be able to do more. We should have more. And I was interested in computing quite early. And what I actually used to do is sell computer games when I was 12, 13. So by the time I left school, the computer equipment I had at home was probably more valuable than the stuff in the school. Because I was just kind of making money from it and then putting it back in. And that gave me a taste for, actually, you know what? You can choose your destiny. You can choose which way you want to go. Porsche 911s and Motorola brick phones and stockbrokers was the thing at that time. I mean, most people probably listen to this thinking, what on earth is this guy talking about?
You said tikini. I said, all right, Serge, I'm not sure what that is.
I thought I was proud of something.
Some designer tops at that time.
And, you know, coming from like an Asian background, I know similarly from like our background, it's like education is a big thing. Was that similar in your household?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, parents were pushing me hard. Like, you know, it's doctor, engineer, or failure. Which one's going to be? Which are three you picking? And it was going to be, we weren't going to be a doctor, we weren't going to be an engineer. You know, I was one of those kids that did enough to not get kicked out. Just enough to get by.
I know the feeling.
F, does that mean I can stay? I'm joking about it now, but it's not that you're lazy, it's that you're interested in other things.
100%.
You just don't apply yourself. I mean, you see it all the time, there are a lot of kids that just, you could see they were intelligent, smart, but they, you know, they weren't academic. They weren't, you know, your A-star students. And I think that was the environment. It's a case of, you know, I wanted to change that and get out of it.
Yeah. So you spoke about your first deal that you accidentally got into. What was that deal, and how did that kind of push you on to try and look at some other stuff as well?
Well, the first property we actually bought ourselves, I first started off sourcing property for... let me kind of give a bit more context first. Yeah. So when I first started looking into property and making money from property, it was going along to a few networking events. It used to be like, I think, 3 or 4 in the whole country at that time. There weren't many. And a few workshops, reading a few books. And there was a lot of stuff around no money down at the time. You can buy houses for nothing, really. And I started learning about lots of different strategies, but the shiny penny syndrome was the biggest challenge, constantly getting distracted. I go to, presentation, someone's talking about they're doing HMOs, they're making £1,000 a month in HMO.
Talk to me about that.
I'm interested.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to learn about that and how that works. And a few months later, somebody else is talking about, they're buying houses for £1. And I think, forget HMOs.
Lease options.
I've got 10 quid, buy 10 houses. Talk to me. A few months later, somebody else is talking about no money down. I think, forget the pound. I'm buying houses for free. And it was this constant jumping around and never really focused. It was just dipping your toe in lots of different things. Looking back now, the advantage was that actually I learned a lot about a lot of different strategies quite quickly. We were talking about this earlier just before we started, doing a lot of different things. But the challenge, I wasn't really getting any results. I was learning about this stuff. And then when I looked at my strengths and got some help about, just put your blinkers on and stop getting distracted by all these other things. Yeah. Just focus on one thing. Yeah. What's the thing you're doing well? I was actually naturally quite happy sitting in people's front room talking to them about, hey, look, we'll buy your property. The market's not what it is, but if you want to get it done, we can do it. And I was quite happy and comfortable doing those things. So I'd generate lots of leads, lots of potential deals. But I actually deep down felt I haven't got the money to buy them. And I felt a bit of fraud sitting there saying, I'm going to buy your house and stuff. And I kind of, so I had a lot of this stuff going on inside. And so my mentor was saying to me, look, what you need to do is just focus on that, find the deals and sell them to other people. There's other people around you struggling for deals, just sell them to them. And that's what I started doing, a couple of £1,000, £3,000, occasionally it's a little bit more. And I was just selling deals for a couple of years or so at least. And that got me... steady in terms of at least there's some income coming in and at least keep a roof over my own head. And then the first deal I actually did, a no money down deal, that was in Stoke-on-Trent. That was an elderly couple. They're probably just a few years older than I am now.
So only 4 years old.
The husband had mobility issues, so he couldn't go up the stairs. It was a 3-bedroom, 2-story house. And they were retiring. They'd found a park home that they wanted to move to. The location was perfect for them, but nobody was buying property at that time. The market was just dead. And so nobody's interested in buying their property. So I went along doing the usual presentation. Hey, we can buy your house, but it's not what it is. The market's this and that. And they were kind of like, okay, what can you do? And I said, well, it can't be this and it can't be this, and offering some silly price. And they said, okay, when could you do it? And I'm thinking,
oh, okay.
Okay. And I said, well, it'd have to be done like this. And I was trying to explain how the nominee down thing would work. And they'd be like, okay, can we get it done by this time frame? And I'm thinking, we could do that. And actually, although I'd heard other people doing it and I was with other people doing it, I hadn't actually done it myself. So I still struggle with the belief. And my wife is massively supportive. But when I come back to her, we're going to buy a house for £1. We're going to buy the highest nominee down. We're going to buy it 50% discount. And she'd think, he's lost the plot and just joined some crazy cult. No money come back all cut. Happy clappy, this is what we're going to be doing. She's saying, really? And who's going to pay the bills?
Exactly. So even with that deal, talk us a little bit, tell us a little bit more, because some people might be listening thinking, no money down, what do you mean by that?
So what we were able to do at that time was if you were able to purchase it at a low enough price, so let me give you some general numbers rather than simple on this, because it will be kind of too messy to try and explain. Let's say the market value is 100,000 and I agree to buy it at, say, 70,000. And so what we would do, we'd buy it for 70,000, but remortgage it for its full value of 100,000 on the same day.
Okay.
So effectively, we'd have a £75,000 mortgage where we only paid 70 grand for the house.
Okay.
All happened on the same day.
Okay.
And so on that particular deal, we got about 4 grand back as a cash back.
Wow.
At that point, my wife was a believer. And that money landed in the account. Really? This is possible? But up until that, even I had doubts that we we could do it. I knew the theory, I knew other people doing it, but until you actually do it yourself, there's always that doubt about is it possible? Can you do it?
Yeah.
And so that was the first deal we managed to structure, complete no money down, that we bought in that way. And at that point, you know, just being completely transparent, I'd messed up my credit file and stuff, I couldn't get any mortgage and stuff at that time and that. And so, you know, we bought it in her name.
Okay.
And that property, we've still actually got that property, but then went on to do a more kind of creative stuff. At that time, you build up your confidence. This is possible. I can do this. And so those sort of deals actually, I think it's about April 2008 that that system came to an end. And you couldn't do it anymore.
I know people are thinking, "Oh man, can I do that one?" Then even I was thinking, "Hey, let's have a chat."
But you know, there's always variations. Like I said, the only certainty in property is constant change.
You just got to be
nimble and you just adapt.
Yeah.
So although that particular way of doing it has finished, these days we talk about no money left in. So you're buying it, but you're getting all your money back out.
Right.
The end point is the same.
Yeah.
You've got a property, you've got none of your money in it, and it's giving you rent every month.
I think that's the biggest probably misconception people have about property investors, property developers, that, you know, you see big houses, refurbs, videos, and you go, man, they just must be loaded all the time. But when you're in it, you realize that most of the time is them being creative, they're raising finance and stuff like that. When did you come up, like, was that the point in time when that kind of, you had that eureka moment where he's like, actually, I don't need to be a millionaire to start in property or like have a crazy job?
Yeah. I mean, I realized early that you didn't need a lot of money because I was constantly being told and I'd hear it from other people. But it's a case of, it's okay for you, but actually, I haven't actually got any money. But how is it going to work for me?
That's it.
So the sourcing stuff was tangible in the sense that I knew I'd secured something, I found someone for 100 grand, we agreed to buy like 80 grand, somebody give me a couple of grand for that. I knew that that would work, and I was doing that time and time again. But then I thought, I'm going to have to do this forever just to keep my bills paid.
Right.
So how's this going to change? And although we did that first one, no money down, and we did a few other things, but primarily what I started, what happened with one deal, which I was selling, the guy's about to get repossessed because a lot of repossessions at that time. And I'd negotiated it, secured it, that we can get this deal done. The person that was going to buy the deal off me, he'd bought property from me before. But he wasn't convinced that my numbers were actually what I was saying they were going to be. And I was all being fairly conservative on my numbers because there was loads of stuff around at that time. It was not like what it is now that we were struggling to find the deals. And in the end, what I said, and what I'd worked out, I said, look, if this guy doesn't buy the deal, the guy that I've been talking to, the seller, he's going to get repossessed. And I've spent months on this and I'm going to get a penny out of it. So I said to him, look, you buy it, don't pay me any fee, and I'll make sure the numbers are what they are, i.e. we'll get the work done in this price. It was only a few grand and we'll get this much rent from it. And then you just pay me a portion of that profit. And that was like my first accidental joint venture. And it wasn't, I mean, it wasn't a lot of money, like 40, some 50 quid, something like that. It was a tiny amount. But the thing, what it did is that the penny dropped that actually, that I'm now going to get that money forever. Do you see? And then I started doing a number of those single lets and stuff. So what I do, I cherry pick the really good deals. And I thought, right, we're keeping this one. Where's my investor? Do you know what I mean?
And how would you fund? So they would fund...
I'd say to them, look, you've just got to put everything in. I'm skint.
Okay.
You put all the money in. I'll run around. I'll get it cleaned up, tied up, get the carpets decorated. I'll find the tenants. I'll get it tenanted. And then we just share the profit, whatever it is.
Wow.
You buy it in your name and stuff and that. And, you know, so it that's how it started.
And you had like an agreement that...
Yeah, so we just had an agreement.
A deed of trust or something like that.
It was a joint venture agreement. Okay. We did a few different versions and then I kind of, as time went on, I should just do what works for that situation. And now I'm a much more stricter, much more structured in how I approach it. By that time, it was, you just got to
hurry up and just get going.
And you got to have that hunger and desire. If you wait to try and get everything perfect, you're just never going to start.
That is key.
You've just got to think, I know this is possible, and you've got to have it in you that you're going to keep going and you've got the motivation, the drive, and you'll figure the stuff out.
Yeah.
And it's not, you're never going to get it perfect. You know, we make mistakes today. We don't say we know everything there is to know.
Absolutely.
And but if we waited, we would never started.
Fantastic. Slad, you sound like you were really, really good at finding deals at the time. What tips would you give on like how you found deals then and how you're finding deals now? Has anything changed or have you pivoted a little bit? Or?
Yeah, I mean, this is really interesting because I think this is really relevant right now because, you know, within our group and our mentoring group and stuff and the people I support, we've been talking about this a lot recently. that these dates I gave earlier on, say up to about 2013, that sort of time frame, a lot of the focus was very different from what we did from 2014 to 2021. Up to 2014, 2021, what we were doing mostly was looking for numbers. What I mean by that is you're trawling through Rightmove, you're kind of people bringing stuff to you, the agents are bringing stuff to you, and you're just looking at numbers. What am I paying for it? What's the work going to cost? What's it going to be worth? What's our profit?
Yeah.
That's all you're doing. It doesn't work next.
Right.
And 90% plus stuff you just dismiss straight away on the offset. And that's what we've been doing for years. The numbers are going to work. If numbers don't work, we're not interested. But actually, prior to that, what we were doing is, you know, we were looking for somebody who needs to sell, or what we call motivated sellers. Somebody had a need to sell. And those people were going to be flexible in either the price or the way we put the deal together, like creativity, lease options, that kind of thing. Now, if we went and viewed 100 properties and they were all up for 100 grand and we offered 80 grand on every single one, apart from probably getting a slap from everyone, you know, you might find somebody might consider that offer. Whereas actually, the reason they would consider it is because their circumstances are probably different. So if I said to you right now, sell me your house for 20% less than it's worth, why would you? Nobody would do that.
Why would they?
But there are certain circumstances that people will be in where they will be more open to doing that, and often a certain pain. And I'm not talking about desperate people, because desperate people are sometimes, they're illogical, they're emotional. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about somebody, for example, you know, who's got another business opportunity. They need to sell this and move on. They've got tax issues. They're going through a divorce. You know, they might have some business debt. So these people will be keen to work with you to get that property moved. And the reason it changed is that in 2013, 2014, that sort of time, more people started coming back to the market to buy property. So the supply and demand shifted. So where I was tripping over deals every day, but there were no buyers. But in the last few years, there's been plenty of buyers for much much fewer stock or quality deals available. But now I think we're changing back to that point. You know, we were joking earlier on that the agents are ringing you back.
We had a couple of scenarios of that.
When did that happen? You know, well, the last few years. And when I first started, we'd take a pack of biscuits, sit down with an agent, have a cup of tea, and be talking for hours because the phone wasn't ringing. Nobody's walking through the door. Damn. It was dead. But I'm not saying it will necessarily go back to that, but there will be aspects of that. So our focus now needs to shift again from numbers back to finding people who are in a certain pain. But now the advantage that we have is tech and data, which we didn't have at that time. So what I mean, for example, is... you know, we can use tools now to find if property's up for sale with multiple agents, if property's up for sale and to let. It's been up for sale, it sold, it came back, it sold, it came back. We've got properties where there's been several price drops. All of these things are a clue that that seller's probably motivated. So if we focus our attention just on those, our chance of success just increased massively because we now focused on a pool of people who are much more likely to give us what we want, which is flexibility in the price, i.e. a discount, or be flexible in how we want to put that deal together, buy now, pay later, you know, all kinds of stuff.
That's fantastic. So would you say even stuff like, because of what you just said, opportunities like lease options and stuff like that, and this might be a good market to start being flexible and looking into things like that? Or
I mean, so I did about 30-odd lease options.
Back
in the day.
Wow.
I got my fingers burnt on about two of them. So, you know, they do sometimes blow up in your face. But actually, if I compare how much money we made versus what we lost, it was that a couple of losses are insignificant. The lease options work really well when the circumstances are right. So sometimes I get frustrated with, you know, property trainers. There are a lot of people that train in property. Some very good and some just... you know, not so good.
No comment.
Not so good. And the ones sometimes that frustrate me the most are they're great at teaching, but they don't actually do any of it. So there's people in the last few years teaching lease options and stuff, and I'm thinking, why are you teaching lease options? They don't work in this market. How many people do you know that have done loads of lease options in the last five, six years? I'm not saying that you can't do them, but there's very, very few people who's actually trying to find a needle in a haystack. So why do you waste time and energy on that, focus on stuff where there's a better opportunity? But now the way the market's going, they will come back because there'll be fewer buyers, so the sellers will be more flexible.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what we're looking for. Absolutely. We're looking for them to be flexible. Ultimately, for a lease option to work, what we want is for them not to need the money from the sale.
Right.
And that's often, there may not be any money from the sale.
Yeah, right.
So for example, we had 95% mortgages happening recently, government guaranteed and stuff. And when we look at those, and let's say we have a fall in the property market, maybe 10%, which is what I think probably will happen, is my guesstimate.
Yeah.
Then those people will be negative equity already.
Already.
And if the interest rates are rising the way they are, some people, are when they come off their current fixed products and stuff, they're going to be in a position where they just can't pay.
Right.
They need to sell. They need to go.
Right.
And when we talk about a motivated seller, ultimately what we're doing, we're trying to resolve their problem.
Yeah.
But the most important part of that is that we don't free them from the problem, then step into their shoes.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
then we're left with a problem.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
we've
got
to have a solution to that problem. And so, for example, in that situation, what we can do is we could turn it into a HMO, we could run it as service accommodation, split it up into three apartments, for example. All these things mean actually that higher mortgage payment is doable. We could do it.
100%. I think what I love about what you said, what you just said there, was just that it's not just about, you know, using any property strategy at any point. Mm. You know what I mean? It's about understanding the market, understanding your personal situation, and then seeing where, you know what strategies work best in that current market. And I think the best teachers, the best people in property, people that are doing the most in property, are always kind of doing that. You know, they don't stick to one strategy necessarily. They may have one or two they kind of go in between and they kind of use when it makes sense. In terms of the next couple of deals that you did after the first couple, where did you start to come into, I guess, some of the other strategies, HMOs, developments? How did that start to get into
so
those
it kind of transitioned from sourcing deals to small buy-to-lets, then small HMOs being four people sharing, then slightly bigger HMOs up to seven people. During that time, we're also flipping some property as well, renovating and selling. Doing some small conversions to apartments, some commercial conversions, and building new houses.
Yeah.
That's kind of been the range of what I've done.
Okay.
But it's all happened gradually, as opposed to doing all those things at the same time.
Yeah.
It's been like, so for example, when we were doing smaller HMOs and starting moving to bigger ones, we were doing more renovations. Mm. So we kind of got skilled up on renovating things. Well, actually, you can buy that one, renovate and sell it whilst we're doing this one to keep.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right.
So my view has always been, don't keep everything. We're selective about what we're doing. Mm. So some we do to keep and some we sell. Really, the only stuff we want to keep is the ones that bring in a high income, which is either HMOs or service accommodation. Anything other than that, I'm not really that interested in keeping in a portfolio. So smaller HMOs is really what, if you want to use the phrase financial freedom, what gave me the financial freedom.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
as I started doing a few, then I jumped into rent-to-rent as well. I could see, actually, I don't need to buy all these. I can just control them and then get the income.
Yeah.
And then did quite a few rent-to-rents for a period of time. And at that time, I was taking mostly student HMOs. If you know parts of Birmingham along Pershore Road, stuff like that, where the students were no longer there because there were new purpose-built buildings. The students were moving closer. So the outer skirt stuff, the landlord was thinking, where are the students gone? Nobody's renting my house. And so you just take that property and just repurpose it to a different audience.
Yeah, professionals.
You just put it on a different, you know, they were advertising directly to students and we stick it on spare room and advertise it to working tenants. And so the HMO side grew quite quickly and we kind of got to about 500 rooms we manage and a combination of own as well.
Wow, that's nice. And obviously now I'm sure it's probably easier for you to raise money now because of what you've done, proof of concept and all of that. How did you find it and how did you actually raise money for these deals when you kind of started and started in HMOs and growing up?
So it was very painful at the beginning. Very painful. A lot of the stuff I've learned the real hard way in terms of when it comes to raising money. But now, you know, what I say is you just need to keep it simple. If you've got a really good deal and people know what you're doing or what you're trying to do, find that money will be much easier.
Mm.
But what the learnings have come from is that we're not actually begging for money. We're not desperate for somebody else's money. We have an opportunity where we're going to make, you know, 50 grand, 100 grand, whatever it might be on a deal or a project. And if somebody else wants to come in and share some of that, hey, you know, that's fine. We can look at that.
Yeah.
Just like any business arrangement, that's what it is. You're helping somebody make money out of it.
Yeah.
Your job is to make sure you deliver on what you say you're going to deliver. Mm-hmm. You de-risk it as much as you possibly can for them. These are the kind of key things that we need to do. But the beginning, you know, I'd be saying, look, you know, I need some money, and so how much need I need? This much? How long do I need for? I need it for this long. And so, what would you, you know, what will they prepare to offer? And they would say, well, I want this. And I say, yeah, I'll do that, whatever it is, and I'll walk your dog on the weekend as well. You know what I mean, anything. Just give me the money.
Whatever it takes.
That's what it was at the beginning. I thought, well, this again, it's not sustainable. Yeah. It's crazy. You can't do it like this. Yeah. You know, you do a few, you get your feet on the ladder and stuff and things, but you know, you've got to change. Mm. And then really, I started getting much smarter in terms of how I approach. Raising money, and then now it's really more about you're always marketing for money, and the best time to look for money is when you don't need it. Now, if you think about when is the bank send you those letters about increasing your overdraft limit or getting an increase on your credit limit,
the other day actually,
when you don't need it. When you're stretching your overdraft to its limit and your credit card's maxed out, you don't get any of those letters. Why? Because they know you're stretching yourself. So the best time to be looking for money is when you don't need it, in the sense that you're just telling people constantly, this is what we do. You know, we work with other people's money. And then those conversations are always happening. So you've got plenty of those going on in your pipeline. And then you're not desperate.
You're more natural as well. It's not forced. It's not full force when you do that.
And we've always been to networking events where somebody jumps up at a networking and says, oh, I've got this amazing deal. I need 50 grand by tomorrow. Who's got it? You know, you can smell that person desperate to try and get that deal done. And it also creates a lack of confidence if that person's not organized enough. And often the lender may not understand that sometimes deals happen very quickly because timing is key. But it just comes across that the person's disorganized. They don't know what they're doing. And I said, if you're not under pressure and you get to choose who you want to work with, and that's what we remember, you know, we're in control. Often people think the people with the money have got the power. They have not got the power. The person with the deal's got the power. You can find plenty of people with the money. If you've got that great deal, they haven't got lots of people to put that money with. And I heard this quote ages ago. I'm not sure if it's Donald Trump one. I think it is. It said, I'm going to probably butcher this, but somewhere along the lines of, you know, when he owed 500,000 to the bank or something, you know, he'd have sleepless nights or something. Or something like 50 million or something like that. He'd have sleepless nights. But when he owes the bank 5 billion, is they're the ones that have the sleepless nights.
Wow. Damn.
You see, so in the sense that the power dynamic shifts. Do you know what I mean? And with property, we have to understand that actually we are doing the most difficult thing, finding the deals, putting the deals together, 100%. Making them work. 100%. The money is everywhere. There's, you know, something like $1 trillion a day changes hands. Just not going through your hands. So you have to position yourself to make sure it's coming your way. And the advantage of that is, if you get good at finding deals, you know, you get skilled up on that thing, you know, there's no glass ceiling in this
for
business.
Real.
It doesn't matter what age, gender, color, it's completely irrelevant. When you've got those deals and you're focused and motivated in terms of what you're doing, you're honest and ethical in the approach, you build that business really, really quick. People will want to work with you. And when you've got a choice, you can be selective. And, you know, when I'd put deals out and I'd say, hey, look, I've got this thing. We talked about it previously. This is what it is. It'd just be a paragraph. And I'd have all the full analysis, but I wouldn't send them everything. I'd just send them the paragraph and I'd say, this is what it is. Let me know your thoughts. If you're interested, please let me know by tomorrow. If it's not for you, that's perfectly okay. I just need to know by tomorrow so I can move on. And it kind of takes a pressure off them a little bit as well, that they're not under pressure. And if they want to do it, great. If not, you know, I can move on. But at the same time, I want them to say no if they're unsure. Because, again, from experience, I've ended up in a situation, okay, we're exchanging contracts today, I need you to send the money across. And you get a text, well, no, I've been thinking about it.
I've had a couple of those.
And so I thought, man, I want to avoid this. I don't want this happening again. And so I'd rather they say no earlier. So I almost invite them to say, look, you know what, it sounds like this might not be for you anyway. We'll find someone else.
Don't worry about it,
because I want to know now. That's not in tip. You know, when we come to exchange in like 6, 8, 10 weeks time. You see, so they're uncertain or they're nervous about something. So it's the only way you could do that is if you've got an abundant number of investors. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're not worried. You say, that's fine. It's not a problem. It's, yeah, I know it's a great deal. We'll talk to somebody else. We'll get it done.
Yeah.
And then after that, you know, rightly or wrongly, my confidence built in the sense that, you know, I'm just going to agree deals when I know we've got no money to do this deal.
Mm.
In the but having the confidence, I know we can find the money.
Okay.
Because it's a good deal.
Yeah.
And you've had lots of conversation. There'll be somebody with it. What I never used to do was mentally bank that money. So if I'm talking to you today, you're saying, I've got a couple hundred grand to invest. What do you think? Oh. And I'm thinking, yeah, that's banked. I've
that's
got 100, that.
100K there? Yeah, yeah, it's true.
Because when I come back to you, you know, you've already chatted to this man over here and that money spent.
Exactly. No, that's true, important. That's about how do you, I know your answer is probably going to be, depends on what situation, but now how do you kind of structure some of your deals? Is it all cash? Do you use development finance? Do you, especially like development stuff, or do you use bridging? Just,
I mean, my the situation is probably a little bit different now than to most people, because it is you're leveraging your brand. That's what I'm doing.
Right.
Saying, look, we've got this track record. We've been doing it for years. We haven't messed up. We've never let anybody down. Go and ask anybody. Go and Google my name. Go and ask anybody on any platform.
Does that help with like bridging companies and development finance companies?
I was going to say, what I tend to do is use all private money mostly. Ah. So we buy everything for cash when we can.
Wow.
Unless it's somewhat really big, then we have to involve your bridges and stuff. But my preference is all private money.
Mm.
Yeah. Use all private money to buy.
Yeah.
So there's two ways. We either borrow the money, minimum 50 grand is what we tend to do. And the reason I do that is so I'm not having lots of conversations with someone's got 3 10K, grand or, you know, and stuff.
Yeah.
And is that why you started to, because obviously you're doing deals in the background and, you know, you're getting on with your portfolio, but is that why you then kind of worked on the Sadio Hussein brand? Was that more to do with the raising of finance whereby you started to document journey? Or was that way down when you started, you already did the loads of deals and you just wanted to kind of teach people? What was
I think... from the offset, I think it was important. Your name is important.
Mm.
That I realized a long time ago.
Mm.
And when I was starting out in property, it's a case of just do what you say you're going to do and build your brand that way.
Mm.
And although I'd been on social media now for probably like 10, 11, 12 years maybe, but I've not really actively built the brand. Mm. All our growth has actually been organic.
Mm.
But I could have done a lot more. Yeah. With that, but now people grow with brands much quicker and stuff. But I think it's exceptionally important, your brand. And your brand is not your logo and your colours, is what people say about you when you're not there.
Let that hit home. I've got another question, and then maybe I can got maybe a couple more, and then we round up. Sad, you've got your networking event that runs monthly or bi-monthly. What would be your advice? What is the best way to network? So for me, what advice would you give anyone out there? Because people don't like networking.
Yeah.
Intimidated, whatever reason. What would you be your best advice to somebody who's going out to their first networking event?
Yeah, I think you hear about property as a people business. And it's not just a cliche. It is all about people.
Mm.
Whether they're somebody you're buying a property from, you're buying it through a funder, a joint venture partner, somebody's doing some work on a property for you. It's all about people. And the best way to grow your network of people is to get out and talk to people. But sometimes, you know, we can be fairly introverted. We don't really want to. We're uncomfortable about that. But, you know, if you are, you know, the first time I went to a networking event, I sat at the chair right in the corner, right at the back by the door, just in case, you know, things get a little bit weird, I'm at that door.
I've never believed that.
Then you realize, actually, you know, there's so much of what you're looking for and you want is in that room. You just got to go and talk to people. So then my strategy was just talk to people and it'd be almost kind of scripted. Hey, how you doing? You've been to this event before. Mm. Tell me about what you do. What got you here today? So a few questions in my head and say, right, I'm just going to flow with that.
Yeah. That's a good starting point.
Yeah, you just have a few questions in your head and think, okay, and then it's a case. And then my favorite question normally would be, tell me what's the one thing that would help you the most today?
Mm.
And I'm thinking, okay, they're looking for this. Who do I know in this room that I can connect them to? And generally just try and connect people. And that. And when you do that a few times, what happens? People start thinking of you first.
Right, because you've helped to give value.
Because you're, like, if you're in a room and you're a regular networker, for example, at one event, and you've done that several times, after a few months, you start seeing it. People start coming to you, approaching to you. Such and said, I need to speak to you. You're the guy for this, or you're the person for that. And it makes it so much easier.
That's so true.
And part of that is really your brand, that you're actively out there helping, connecting, networking with other people.
Yeah.
And if you're going to sit at home, you know, on your computer and be your laptop warrior, then you can't expect the same results.
Facts.
You've got to get outside 100%. The comfort zone.
Facts.
I mean, Serge, your mentality is commendable, man, to be honest. Your whole story, thank you for being so honest as well about your whole journey as well. Like, just coming into the property game, you know, there used to be a lot of a side where I used to see they used to go through the strategies, and there's another side that would go about mindset. Mm. And I won't lie, I used to get angry when I see
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But the older I've gotten and the more experience I've gotten in property, you know, mindset is important. And then everyone Absolutely. Has their own ways they do things. Is there any things that you do to kind of keep you sort of motivated, you know, stay
Yeah, I mean, my thing is every day is like, you know, it's a blessing. You don't know how long your life is. You don't know whether you're going to be here. And we all know somebody that we'd be the last, or so know somebody that's lost somebody close.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not because they were in their 90s. So, you know, tomorrow isn't guaranteed to everybody. And my faith, my religion is very, very important to me. Mm. And, you know, God's put us here for a reason. And, you know, if I can help and serve other people, you know, I build something that makes a difference to other people. That just drives me massively. Mm. You know, when I started this business, it was a case of, yeah, I need to get back on my feet. I need to pay my bills. I'm going to go after my kids.
Right.
Then it was a case, okay, I need to build something for my kids. We were talking about them earlier. Three of them already involved in the business. My wife's involved in the business. About 23, 24 staff in the business. So, you know, if I stopped today, you know, I'd be okay. My kids would probably be okay. Mm. Maybe even their kids would be okay if they were sensitive about, you know, what they do. Mm. But that isn't what drives me. It's a case of, you know, how can we achieve more, do more, be more, give more, make a difference? That for me is really important. Yeah. And just like yourself, for me, mindset was one of those things. Why are you talking about mindset? Tell me about property. That's what I'm here for.
Money
yeah. Where's that fitting? Am I going to sit here and manifest money's going to just arrive in my lap? Tell me about, you know, how I'm going to make money from property. But yeah. I realized, because I'd always been self-employed, I was of the, you know, I had that hunter mindset that I've got to go out and put food on the table. Mm. Nobody's going to put food. I'm not going to get home and there's going to be some food on the table. I've got to bring the food.
Facts.
So that I always had that mindset. But when I actually came into property, many people from property had day jobs. Mm. And they were either coming out of jobs or they're from corporate background. Mm. And they were used to a much more cushy environment. So they didn't have that necessarily that belief, I've got to create this and, you know, I can change my life. And for me, it was a bit of a reality shift. Well, actually, doesn't everybody think the same way?
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's all I know. When you run your own business, it's very difficult in the sense that you don't have these sort of conversations with your staff. And realize then actually mindset is super important. Yeah. And sometimes we are fortunate that it's a default thing that just happens. Other times we have to work at it, but it's absolutely key.
100%, man. 100%. And just rounding off, I mean, we're getting into 2023. You spoke about, you know, 10 years ago about, you know, the 2008 recession and some of the strategies that were used then and how it sounded similar now. Like going into 2023, what strategies are you going to be working on? What strategies would you suggest young people to use to get in the market? Like what would you say?
Yeah, I think what's that? So can you smell it? It's the money.
Hey there, guys.
2023 and 2024 is going to be your rarest opportunity to make the most amount of money.
Come on.
It's going to be like, you know, if you're thinking when's the right time, it's here.
Wow.
It's here, guys.
It's literally here now, and it ain't going to be around long. Because things can change very quickly. There's many levers in the property economy that can move and adjust and complete change of market. And now, because we were talking about earlier, such as your sellers going to be more open, more flexible, there are going to be a lot of those people around. So this is the perfect time, for example, to control properties. Not even about ownership but control. We mentioned Donald Trump earlier on, whether you like him or hate him, or if you understand his background, he built his empire through controlling property.
Wow.
Not by buying property, through controlling it. Mm. And in the same way, the opportunities are going to exist. Now, if I look back now, some of the deals we did, you know, we bought stuff which is just bog standard. When I say bought, we took it on a lease option, little two-bed house or something that we just rented out. And as we exited out of those, we worked how much money, we made like 70 grand, 80 grand, 100 grand we made out of those deals, which at the time didn't really look nothing amazing. Right. But when you work it out, the rental profit we've had, the equity we built in them, 100%. And what do we pay for them? A pound.
Crazy.
It's unreal. So I think control, the opportunities that are going to be there are going to be phenomenal to do that. Discounted property, distress sales, there's gonna be a huge number of those. Finding those, negotiating those, selling those to other people, that's gonna be your your lowest hanging fruit for the next couple of years.
Amazing Thank you, Saj. You honestly are a legend in this property game.
Facts.
We thank you so much for showing us love and coming down. We're so passionate about next year, not only talking to young people that are in the game, but actually bringing the wiser heads, you know, to really help us, guide us through the next couple of years. So really appreciate you. Everything you've done, your story, it's literally phenomenal. So
thank you.
Thanks for coming down. We really appreciate you. And yeah, man, That's it for this episode.
That's it, guys.
I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you took plenty of notes.
Yep.
We'll be back soon. So stay blessed, stay invested.
Peace.
Thank you.